Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jess Walter, whose latest novel is Beautiful Ruins. Earlier novels include The Financial Lives of the Poets, The Zero, Citizen Vince, which won an Edgar Award. There are six novels in all, plus one nonfiction book about Ruby Ridge. Jess Walter, when I was reading Financial Lives of Poets, I'm thinking, wow, this guy kind of writes, sort of writes a little bit like Carl Hiaasen or Elmore Leonard. Then I picked up Beautiful Ruins, and it's a romance spanning 50 years. It's very, very different. You said you don't like to get typecast at all, but you also said that each book I write is kind of a reaction to the last one. So let me start there. How is Beautiful Ruins a reaction to The Financial Lives of the Poets?
I work on two or three things at a time, and I don't know a lot of authors who are able to do that. But I was working on Beautiful Ruins and The Zero at the same time. And The Zero was such a dark, dark book that when I finished it, I wanted to make something beautiful. I wanted something in which I luxuriated in the sentences. And I was so proud of The Zero, but it's very much a dark satire of its time about our reaction to terrorism, about what I think was a sort of cultural insanity that we all went through. So, you know, Beautiful Ruins was very much an attempt to write something else. I hit a wall with it in about 2008. I finished it, but it wasn't what I wanted it to be. And I set it down and I wrote Financial Lives of the Poets, which is very, very different in voice and structure. Beautiful Ruins is a more elaborately structured, more written novel, honestly. With Financial Lives of the Poets, I said, I'm going to get out of my way and just spin a story. I'm going to introduce this guy, and the book is going to take place in a short amount of time. It'll be a classic four-day descent. I imagined it like the top of the roller coaster, just when you're about to go over, and then the book is just that drop. And then when I went back to Beautiful Ruins, it was as if I'd had this great palate cleanser, and I could really embrace the more lush, rich style of that novel.
So in that sense, Beautiful Ruins was the reaction to The Zero. Financial Lives of Poets was the reaction
right.
to Beautiful Ruins.
Yeah, it feels sometimes like I am trying to get the taste of the last book out of my mouth. But, you know, I actually started Beautiful Ruins in 1997. It was an idea that I have had forever, and I would go back to it a little bit at a time. And I think that shows kind of in the end in the kind of relationship I had with the characters. I really felt as if these were people I had carried around gently in my hands with me for the last 15 years.
Well, the book itself spans these 50 years. Not only does it span 50 years, but it spans a very, very large cast of characters and their fiction slash nonfiction. There's a novel that isn't a novel and a play that's actually not fiction either,
right,
within the context of the story, though, of course, there are changes. You're playing with that. I understand that in 1997, your wife is Italian, you went to Italy.
The Cinque Terre is the place we went, the five lands built, these cliffside villages built into the Ligurian coastline.
And at that particular time, you went out for hikes and you found these old ruined villages.
Yeah, I mean, the Cinque Terre is a very popular tourist destination, but there were these other little clusters of stone buildings and houses that some of them no longer existed. They'd been taken over by parkland. And so in my mind, I invented a town, Port of Agonia, Port of Shame, and that became the sort of fictional vessel that I started throwing my story into. And it allowed me the freedom of writing about a specific place, but having the fictional freedom to create what I wanted to create, a hotel with the unlikely name, the Hotel Adequate View, you know. And so it was a way to write about a specific place, but to also do it with, you know, as a fiction writer.
So at that particular time, the town and the hotel kind of existed, and Pasquale, the character there, might have existed in one form or other.
My mother was ill, and she never got to travel very much. And the first impulse was, I want to write a sort of magical realism novel about a place in which cancer can't kill this young woman. And I made the woman about my mother's age, arriving there in the early 60s. I have a penchant for the early 60s. I drive an old 63 Lincoln Continental convertible, and I love films from that period and clothes. And so it just felt like a more romantic time, and a time when Italy wasn't as ruined by tourism. And so that was the first impulse. And so in those first years, like a lot of fiction writers, you know, we were always told that the characters would take over the action. So all we had to do was sort of put them in the world and they would go about their business. And my characters tend not to. They tend to turn on the television and open a beer. For a few years, I had this woman getting out of a boat, Dee Murray, and I had this young man, Pasquale Torsi, watching her. And the novel didn't progress too much beyond that. I think over the years it became about storytelling itself. And so all those forms you talk about, which I think is sort of represents in miniature the kind of writing I like to do. I like to write all kinds of different things in all different kinds of voices. And so I think the novel represents that for me.
Jess Walter, was that the period when you were doing ghost writing?
Yeah. My first nonfiction book, Every Knee Shall Bow, which was later retitled Ruby Ridge, had appeared, and I was desperate to not go back to my daily newspaper job. I'd worked in newspapers since I was 19. I'd always wanted to be an author, and I first helped Christopher Darden with his book about the O.J. Simpson murder trial. He was a prosecutor in that trial, which wasn't technically a ghost-written project because my name's on the cover. And then I did a couple more. It was never something I liked doing. It always felt a little bit like money laundering, you know, like I was taking someone else's ideas and putting them through my business, you know.
Was Beautiful Ruins, in that sense, your first novel?
You know, I had written two failed novels before. I had been sending out short stories forever. I was sort of self-taught. I don't have an MFA. I'm not sure, actually, if I have a bachelor's degree, I'd have to. There might have been some string pulling there. But I was really teaching myself to write. I was writing short stories and sending them out. I used to call them Manila boomerangs because I would send them out. 3 weeks later, they would come back to me. And I was trying to write novels. I had started two, and they were set in Spokane. And I had decided, you know, in about 1997, that Spokane, Washington, my hometown, was a flat place to write fiction, that I needed some place like Italy, like the Cinque Terre, to make it come alive. And so this was my attempt to write about a setting that was more romantic.
You said you sent all these short stories out. Which was the first one that was published?
The first success I had in short stories, it wasn't actually published. There was a magazine called Story Magazine. I entered their short fiction contest, and they had 9,000 entries, and I finished in 25th place. And they didn't publish it, but they put my name in the magazine, and they sent me a check for $25. And I remember putting that up on my bulletin board. It's still there now, an uncashed check for $25 from Story Magazine. And I remember thinking, 7 years, $25, and now I'm a professional. I think it's a very typical story of writers. You know, you're going to have to learn somehow. And journalism was such a great place for me. It was like being a piano player in a bar somewhere. You get your chops. You may not play the songs you want to play. You have to play whatever requests they throw at you. But I felt like when I left there, I could write anything. I could write quickly. And then it was doing what every writer does, which is trying to find your voice and the kind of stories that you want to tell.
From what I've seen, talking to a lot of writers, two elements of newspapers. Well, there's a multiple series of elements. One is you learn how to research.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That's the first. The second is you have an editor telling you what's wrong.
Right.
And the third is you get over writer's block because yes. You have to write no matter what.
Yeah. There's no fear of publication. Right. I remember being, when I was an undergrad and taking writing classes, people would say, oh, it just, you know, the muse didn't strike. It didn't speak to me, you know. And, yeah, writer's block is called unemployed in journalism. And you lose that fear of publication, too. I could write a short story or work on a novel and not feel as if it had to say everything I had to say as a writer. I always felt like there was going to be another at bat. And for me, that's key. I want to just keep hitting, you know.
Well, there's a character named Alvis Bender who writes a novel but can't get past one chapter in Beautiful Ruins, Jess Walter. And it seemed to me that at any time he could have woken up and said, this is a short story. Time to move on.
Right. And I think finally Dee sort of gives him the permission to do that. You know, it's funny, you know, if you imagine working on this book for 15 years and having it bedevil you and not being able to get it right, so much of that gets poured into the novel itself. And so there are times I felt like Alvis Bender and this was the book I couldn't finish. For me, it was a way to cure writer's block was rather than sit and struggle over the same thing, I, back in the mid-90s, decided, you know what, if I get stuck on this, I'll move on to something else. And it's how I think I'm able to work on two or three different things at once, to write essays and criticism and movie scripts and poems and short stories and, you know, the form I love best, the novels.
At what point did you begin work then on Over Tumbled Graves?
Over Tumbled Graves was probably in about 99 or 98.
You already had Pasquale and you put it aside.
I had Pasquale and Dee and it felt too... I couldn't reanimate the world. I heard a painter one time say that sometimes he goes back to a painting and there's nothing he can do. The paint has just dried. And I felt as if the paint had dried. I couldn't find my way around it. And so I did what they tell writers to do, which is write something you know, write something more familiar. And Over Tumbled Graves is a crime novel set in my hometown. It was much more, I think, approachable for a writer my age and my abilities at the time. I don't think I could have written Beautiful Ruins in back then, even if I had been able to finish it.
Then came Land of the Blind and Citizen Vince, and suddenly you were being typecast as a mystery writer, a thriller writer.
I was. I always thought I was writing literary fiction that happened to center around crime, you know, Richard Price or something like that. And there are no better readers in the world than mystery readers. They're incredibly loyal, devour books, but they tend to like series. They want the same detective or civilian to be solving crimes over and over. And I always feel like, you know, like the 14th time the librarian solves a murder, wouldn't you just stop going to that library? You know, wouldn't you think maybe that it was cursed in some way? So for me, I never wanted to write a series. You know, I still like the propulsion of crime fiction. It isn't that people read them because people have some bloodlust or something. I think they like to be pushed through a novel. They want it to propel them along. And I try to bring that quality to, I guess, literary fiction or to straight fiction.
In 2010, in an interview, you said you couldn't think of anyone who'd started a career as a crime writer and then became a literary novelist. John Le Carré started as a spy novelist,
right.
And Dennis Lehane has made the transition.
Yeah.
Evan Hunter / Ed McBain. Lisa C. has done it more recently. And then you've got Walter Mosley, Michael Connelly.
Yeah, I think they would still be classified more as crime novelists, as very good crime novelists. You know, it's very hard to break out of those genres once, you know, and I think you could go back to Chandler and Kane and Hammett. There's nothing but literature in those guys, you know. Kane especially, I think, affected literary fiction in a way that a lot of writers haven't. It's not a path that seemed very promising at the time. I was incredibly honored to win the Edgar Award. Then the danger then is that's what publishers want. They want, you know, more crime fiction from you. And I didn't feel like I was writing strict crime fiction in any way.
Well, before we move on to The Zero and the later books and get back into how Beautiful Ruins kind of wove its way through your other books, 2001, you were doing some research on Bernard Carrick, and you happened to be at Ground Zero?
Yeah, it was actually one of those ghostwriting projects. My publisher had signed him to a deal. I was writing Citizen Vince, and I wanted New York Cops. And she said, I know a great New York cop. You know, he's got this autobiography he needs some help with. And I said, I don't want to do a ghost job. It's not a ghost job. It's an editing job. And Judith Regan, my old publisher, I love her. I think she's wonderful. But she had a way of talking me into things. And so I ended up, you know, helping him with his book, and it was finished right when the terrorist attacks occurred. And so the book was sort of rewritten, and I found myself at Ground Zero 5 days after the attacks. Spent a few weeks there and helped, you know, at first just did what anyone did, handed out granola bars and did what you could, which was very little. I mean, there was nothing to be done. But I was at the site, and then over the following weeks found myself both disturbed by what I saw there, by the politicization of what had happened, and also a kind of post-traumatic break from reality that I felt like settled over the entire nation, this kind of consumer nationalism that had us acting in ways that seemed sort of insane. And so all of that led to me writing The Zero, you know, a dark satire in which our reaction to terrorism fractures the main character and drives him, you know, toward almost a kind of insanity.
Well, what do you think of the truthers today?
Being a journalist by training, I tend to not be a conspiracy theorist because conspiracies take so much work. You know, it takes so many people to pull something like that off. And I think of the universe as being a little more random and chaotic. Not that there are not conspiracies. There are conspiracies every day. But the larger the conspiracy, the less I usually tend to think that it's true. However, I think, you know, the interesting thing about any conspiracy is that it, you know, it's rooted in a kind of anxiety that hangs over the culture. I think that's why Don DeLillo is so brilliant, because he captured that sense of cultural anxiety, you know, from Libra, which is about the Kennedy assassination and that conspiracy, all the way through later books in which there's some sense that things don't add up, and that's a really natural inclination.
Jess Walter, when you were working on these books, Citizen Vince and then The Zero, where was Beautiful Ruins? Was it just at that point still sitting in either your computer or desk drawer?
When I go back to a book, I start from the very beginning, and I tear it down to its first sentence, and I start over, and I write all the way through. And I had done that a couple times. By then, it had grown into a version of what it is now. I had had some dealings with Hollywood and realized that my actress, Dee Murray, was working on Cleopatra. And so I had started research into that. I had the character of the producer, Michael Dean, you know, this sort of shark who became a character that I became sort of crudely fascinated by. Yeah, and so a lot of the characters had come into being. The parts hadn't come together in the puzzle yet. But I probably had 100, 150, 200 pages of the book, and it would be fun to work on, and I would find myself engaged by the characters, but the story itself and how to frame it usually escaped me. I made quite a bit of progress on it before I jumped back into The Zero, and then The Zero was a book that felt like I had to write it. I couldn't not work on it, and I was driven in that way and set Beautiful Ruins aside until I finished it.
What was the working title at the time?
The book was called The Hotel Adequate View. That's what it was called until about 2008 or 2009 when I was researching Richard Burton and came across this amazing quote that in his 50s, he was while he was on the Dick Cavett show, he was already a beautiful ruin. And at that moment, I had one of those writer epiphanies in which I thought, that's what I've been writing about the whole time, that state of ruination and, you know, and yet the beauty that can come out of it, these very flawed characters, their sort of hairy ambitions, and yet my affection for them never wavered. That became, you know, almost a kind of motto for the book.
When your wife saw you working on the Hotel Adequate View book again, would she say, "So, is that ever going to be finished?"
You know, my wife almost never asks what I'm working on.
Really? Yeah,
because if I say I'm working on something, it might not ever appear. You know, I'll tell her about a short story, and she'll ask what happened to the short story, and I say, it's not done. You know, my files are full of printouts, and my computer is full of half-finished ideas. And you know, I think when you start out as a writer, you take it for granted that a lot of the things you write are not going to go anywhere. And I think I hit a little better, but I think I still hit maybe like a, you know, weak hitting second baseman. You know, I think I still hit only about 270, and the rest of the ideas, I don't know where they're going. So I would tell her a little bit about Beautiful Ruins, and she was more attached to it because she's Italian and we'd been to Italy. But it wasn't until I went back to Italy in 2008 that I think I really got my arms around it and started speaking about it seriously as the next book.
Gradually, the book is emerging. At this point, you've got Richard Burton, you've got Michael Dean, the producer. Is it still mostly set in 62, or was the breakthrough realizing that you were going to span the 50 years and that it would immediately shift from Pasquale to this character of Claire, who is Dean's assistant?
That did happen pretty early on, that I thought I would tell parallel stories. I mean, the book is really propelled into space by this moment in which Pasquale and Dee meet, and he falls in love, not so much with her, because he doesn't even know her, but with the moment. And looking back and imagining a moment so profound that it affects two people, even though maybe they don't end up together, and this idea of that romance might be the most profound if it's unrealized in some way. And, you know, propelling that made me ask the question, then what is the effect of that? And so I did pick up the story. I mean, when I started, it wasn't 50 years later. It was 40 years later or 35 years later. The people were much younger. I kept sort of pushing it back. And I would have these dealings in Hollywood and find myself wanting to satirize the crazy meeting culture and the insane pitch culture. And so those were sections that I wrote. I never wanted to get too far from Pasquale and Dee, at least in their drive being what pushes this book along.
But if you go too far in that direction, you wind up with Nicholas Sparks' The Notebook.
Yeah, no, and I'm not sentimental by nature, and I wasn't too worried about broaching sentimentality because these are flawed characters leading difficult lives. The thing I wanted to do was show that could be every bit as romantic and lovely as, you know, two people meeting cute and then, you know, coming back together every 10 years or something. You know, I wanted it to have the sort of messiness of realism, but to have that big sweep of 50 years.
When you bring in Claire and then you bring in the pitch man,
Shane right, yeah.
And Claire's boyfriend, and then move along from there, we've suddenly expanded well beyond the story of two old people who may or may not get together by the end of the book. We've moved in a completely different direction. Then we take another direction, which is Dee's son, Pat, and his whole life. And it occurred to me on some level, because you have talked a little bit about how the autobiography is the tool of the fiction writer, that there might be a little bit of Jess Walter and Pat Bender. Is that right or wrong?
Yeah, I you know, I always defer to Marilyn Robinson's great answer when someone asked her, any of these characters you? And she said, oh, my goodness, yes, all of them. But, yeah, I definitely have a much cleaner life than Pat Bender, who's a failed musician who is sort of driven by the idea of fame and of success and whose appetites derail him. Mine tend not to, but it doesn't mean I don't have the appetites. And so, yeah, I do think there are levels of autobiography. I think that sort of autobiography informs the work and works at a deeper level. I don't, you know, there are very few places in which you could point to the characters and say, well, that looks like you. Financial Lives of the Poets, which is about a former journalist who lives in the house I live in.
And loses it.
And loses it. You know, a lot of people will feel like, wow, that's such an autobiographical book. And to me, it doesn't feel any more autobiographical than Beautiful Ruins. Another of my favorite authors, Kurt Vonnegut, said, you know, this isn't what life is, this is what life feels like. And I think that's what every fiction writer is trying to do, trying to find characters, almost like an actor, through which you can animate them with your own, you know, sort of deep feelings or philosophy or, you know, or understanding of the world.
Janet Maslin in The Times said something about Beautiful Ruins being kind of this romantic train wreck.
I mean, yeah.
You can't keep your eyes off the train wreck and the romance. And that immediately reminded me that all of Financial Lives of the Poets is one giant train wreck.
Yes. It's all a train wreck. Yeah, I suppose maybe that's the journalist in me. Our lives fall apart. We build them up and entropy or something tears them apart. And I'm interested in those lives. And Pat Bender, the Dee's son, has a life that he keeps exploding himself. And I found myself drawn to him, drawn to a character like Richard Burton and his self-defeating appetites. And, yeah, those characters have incredible draw for me, which is odd for someone who, you know, practices the self-discipline with writing that I do and, you know, quietly raises his kids and doesn't smack heroin as Pat Bender does.
The character in Financial Lives of the Poets, Matthew Pryor, as you were writing him and as he kept making one terrible decision after another, you know, you could see that Beautiful Ruins is a construct. It's like a building. Financial Lives of Poets is more like a road.
Yeah, it is. Once I started writing that book, it was the summer of 2008, and the very first thing I imagined was this guy walking in a 7-Eleven store, and sometimes you get a voice in your head, and I had the voice of this guy longing for his youth, standing in a store where stoned kids were buying munchies. And then often I'll ask myself, well, who is this guy? And immediately I saw him as, you know, as someone about to make a series of awful mistakes. And the series of unfortunate events that he's going to endeavor to make are, in each step, ostensibly to fix this problem, but to make it worse, to make it deeper. And the comic possibilities of that excited me, but also the human possibilities. I mean, it's really easy to think back to sort of the low point of your own life, to imagine when you were the poorest. And when I started writing that book, I remembered at one point I was a newspaper reporter. I was divorced. I was living on a friend's couch. I had just been sued for a story that I'd written, and I was being deposed that day. And I was on crutches from a bad knee, and I had a broken collarbone. And I was driving down the freeway, and my car broke down. And I got out, and I was hitchhiking to the courthouse to be deposed in a trial against me, thinking, well, you know what? This is not bad, because this has got to be the low point of my life, you know? And how great to be in the middle of the low point of your life. And no, it can only go uphill from here. And I swear to God, 10 minutes later, it started raining. So as if someone said, no, there's more we can do. And so I wanted to put Matt at almost like Job in the Bible, just heap upon him every indignity that I could find and see how he reacted.
What was the lawsuit against the story?
It ended up being dismissed. It was this crazy story in which the state was going after this man for child welfare and custody payments, and his father had the same name. And they went after the father. And then once they got their hooks into the father, they decided they'd squeeze him until they found the son. So I wrote, a series of stories and ended up being sued by the prosecutor in the case who said that I slandered her and belittled her. And the case, it was such a strange thing for a prosecutor to allege slander.
And on a newspaper?
On a newspaper story, right. I think it was just a sort of harassment. But at the time, you know, as a 26-year-old reporter, I was terrified.
Have you ever thought about using that little bit of your life?
I have. You know, I feel like I have all sorts of scraps of anecdote and story that I'll fall back on sometimes, you know, popping out of drawers all over my office.
The story of Alvis Bender in World War II, which kind of comes in the middle of the book, and at first it's a head-scratcher, but it later kind of works. And where did that come? Was that always part of Beautiful Ruins?
It's so funny because Alvis Bender is a writer who arrives on the shore of Puerto Vigonia and befriends Pasquale's family and is the one American that they know before Dee Murray arrives. And that character really came about because I desperately wanted to call the Hotel Adequate View, which couldn't be less Italian. Italians, everything is bravissimo, is big and bold. And I kept thinking, well, how would this place be called that? And so I invented a conversation in which this American travel writer at the time explains that language is a currency and that Americans will be more drawn to the place if there's less hyperbole. And then I thought, well, maybe he's even doing this out of self-interest. He doesn't want this place to be ruined. And slowly that character rose out of that little seed to become this tortured writer who had been in World War II, had this odd encounter with a young village girl and, you know, had this one chapter about it. And I always sort of knew that he would figure in a deeper way in the novel once I realized he was there when Dee Murray was there. And so it became, you know, trying to find a way to feather those stories in. And it was a character as I said, when you have a character around like that for more than 10 years, it's amazing how you grow fond of him and care for what happens to him.
Epiphany of 2008 when you went back to Italy. Is there any particular thing that said, this is why the book will work now?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'd rediscovered Richard Burton by that time. I'd finished a draft and had given it to a close friend, and both he and I agreed it wasn't ready. And then I was called to Italy to speak to a university there, American students studying there. And so I had a few days, went back to the Cinque Terre, hiked it with a friend. And that night, after we finished hiking, we had a couple glasses of wine, and I started writing in my journal. And I keep a detailed writing journal all the time that is almost like looking over my own shoulder. And it's best because you're writing so close to those characters and to their lives and you're in scenes. With this journal, I try to take a longer look. I step back and try to describe to myself what it is I'm doing and keep track of that bigger picture, the larger movements of the story. And I had a couple of things. I realized that when I went back to the book that I had to build to that moment when Pasquale and Dee see each other again, that was going to be a huge moment, but that wouldn't be the last moment of the book. And as I said, I imagined I was carrying these characters around and gently sort of moving them through their difficult lives. And in that journal that night, as I stayed up all night writing, I wrote 26 pages, and I wrote that at the end, I wanted it to feel as if I had sort of let those characters go, like letting dandelion seeds go in the air or letting some marbles roll out on them, that I carried them around carefully and that the last chapter would have a movement in which the whole story, you know, all these lives were allowed to sort of drift out into the world. And that was what I started writing toward, this last chapter of present tense in which the book becomes less romance to me and more a sort of existential question, this idea that these moments can be so incredibly powerful that they can define our lives, that we can have a life we chose and a life we didn't, and that the power of those things can stay with us forever.
Well, it struck me in that last chapter, you said again in that 2010 interview, you said that the fiction writer's goal is not to give you what you expect, but to give you something that's satisfying, which you didn't see coming,
right,
which strikes me as what you were deliberately attempting to do in that last chapter.
Thanks. Yeah, I think it's what I almost always attempt to do. It's the hardest part of a book, and so many books let down for me. In Citizen Vince, three books ago, Vince Camden, the hero, has recently taken up reading, and he finds himself dismayed at how most novels don't end well, and so he stops reading the endings. He stops at about 40 pages from the end. He usually puts the book down because he doesn't want to be disappointed. And that can be the danger. With this book, I really felt as if I had a sort of full emotional sweep, and I had a reason for the stories that you get little glimpses of throughout. You know, this story has breadth, I think, for me. It has depth, too, hopefully, but it covers different lives at different times, and I wanted that breadth to be represented in a big sweeping last chapter.
The scene it seemed you were coming toward was the scene where Dee, with Lydia and Pat in tow and Pasquale in another room because he can't go,
right.
Dee saying, telling Pat exactly who he is, and
yes.
You chose deliberately not to have that scene in the book.
I did. It felt to me like that scene needed to be off stage. It felt to me as if we knew what happened. We were all there, and it was almost a moment in which you give your characters privacy to have that moment between themselves. And I think, for me, it was an important idea within the book that the power of identity is such that, you know, these people defining who they are through the stories they tell, through their art, through their music, that their self-identity in some way means everything to them. And so I was building to this moment in which Pat's identity is answered in a way that I think allows him to find some tenuous connection back to his life and maybe even redeem sort of some of his real father's promise.
Were there any characters, any sequences that you had in the book and that at some point you just said, this one doesn't fit?
Oh, yes. I mean, if I were to lay out every version of this book, it would be 12,000 pages, I think. I was cutting things all the time. At one time, Dean's assistant was a young man. At one time, the person pitching the movie was a young woman. I had Dee's parents in there for a while. I had her sister in scenes, Alvis Bender's family. There were so many sections that I wrote that in the end I knew didn't fit, but I was just sort of getting to know the character. One of the strangest things I did in a postmodernist whiff was to put myself in the book at one point. I went in and pitched a film version of The Zero of one of my own novels, and I was the least believable fictional character I've ever created. I couldn't find myself in any way on the page, so thankfully I set that aside. But yeah, I love the process of writing myself into an alley or into a wall and then saying no and backing up and trying to find my way back in.
Well, I understand, I hadn't read the book, Citizen Vince, but I understand Vince makes an appearance in Financial Lives, which of course I didn't recognize.
Sure, right.
Does he make an appearance in Beautiful Ruins?
He doesn't. I love when a writer has a sort of fictional word. Larry McMurtry will do that. Characters will appear because they would naturally appear in the same world. You know, because of where Beautiful Ruins takes place, you know, it ventures from Italy to Hollywood to the Northwest to, you know, to all sorts of places and times. It would have been really shoehorning him in. You know, Citizen Vince takes place in Spokane. The Financial Lives of the Poets, while not named, takes place in a setting that's clearly Spokane. So it was just more natural to sort of drop in a line about what he was doing then.
Did you have any questions about putting in some of the sequences from Donner, the movie, the worst movie ever pitched?
Yeah. There is a movie pitch in here, and I was so interested in that form of pitching that I pitched Citizen Vince first as a film, actually, and was told afterward by the producer that it might have been the worst pitch he'd ever heard. But he was intrigued enough that he sent me away to write the script, and I finished the script and turned it in, and he said, I have to tell you, this is the most literate script I've ever read. And I said, wow, thank you. And he said, no, that's not a compliment. So this reads like a novel, and that really is my form. But I was so interested in that idea of a pitch, and I kept trying to think of the least likely film that could be made now. I don't think it's the worst pitch ever. I just think it's the least likely. In fact, I had a couple of Hollywood producers that I'd met on various things call me and say a couple things. Number one, can we have some of your reality TV show ideas because they're great? Which I said, you do realize that the levels of satire are now blinding because you actually like these ideas that I was making fun of reality television. But I also had a couple say that the pitch for a movie about the Donner Party was incredibly moving. And I had a literary journal actually excerpt it. as a small piece of literary writing, because it's a form we don't always see.
Anybody want to put on Lydia's play?
Yeah, I'd love to. I found myself, I've really found myself moved. I kind of want to finish that play.
It does bring up a couple of questions. First of all, has Hollywood actually taken in more than just a pitch on any of your books? Because I looked up IMDb, and the only thing I saw was that there was a film version of Ruby Ridge, but that's it.
That's the only thing that's been made. Financial Lives of the Poets, I wrote a script, and it's set to go into production in November. Michael Winterbottom, the great British director, is, as they say in Hollywood, set to helm. So,
do they have
an
actor?
Jack Black is attached to it. Sony is distributing, and nice mid-indie movie budget. And so, yeah, I hope that one will go through. I'm really happy with the script. I like the work down there. I've written two or three scripts, a couple with a writing partner, that haven't been made. But I love working down there. I find myself sort of in that place between Claire and Michael Dean, hopeful and cynical at the same time.
It seemed to me, you know, that if somebody wanted to take Beautiful Ruins, they'd probably ruin it.
Well, I've talked to a few people. I've talked to some directors and producers who are interested in it. And, you know, it could be difficult to do, certainly. And I don't, you know, it would take exactly the right combination of people. And I think it's probably got less of a chance of being a film than some of my other books.
One issue, as I said, is that you've got things like The Notebook, and there would be a tendency to say, okay, you know, now what we're going to do is we'll have Judi Dench playing, you know,
right,
D,
right.
And suddenly we've got the best exotic Marigold Hotel.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, I think what we think of as Hollywood is the studio system. And the studio system's not making books like this into films. You know, there's a piece in The New Yorker, it's a story by Tad Friend about Ben Stiller, in which a studio executive says, look, if a 19-year-old boy isn't going to go see it, we're probably not going to make it. But the studio system is not all of entertainment. There is a great, thriving indie film scene that I hope and think will become even more thriving. And so I think that there are a lot of opportunities for things to be made into great films that maybe won't have the wide release of a big Hollywood blockbuster, but maybe don't need them, just need, you know, some smart adults to go see.
Well, then you've also got HBO and Showtime.
HBO and Showtime. I think we're at a golden age of television right now. I mean, some of the really, really wonderful stuff. And again, it doesn't need to open with a $180 million weekend. You know, these things can have a smaller audience and therefore not pander to the lowest common denominator.
Well, when you were working on Beautiful Ruins, how many times did you see Cleopatra?
I probably saw it. You really can't see it more than a couple times without wanting to gouge out your eyes. It's really pretty awful. But I did watch it a few times. And, you know, and there is one of the first times I watched it, one of the things I noticed was a lady in waiting next to Elizabeth Taylor, a tall blonde woman.
Oh, really?
Who became sort of my model for Dee Murray, an actual actress who was cast in the film as a blonde Egyptian slave. So,
you know, in retrospect, of course, a lot of themes don't emerge until other people tell you about them. And it seems that one of the themes of the book is the nature of our celebrity culture.
Yeah.
And personal branding. Was that always in the back of your mind, or is that something, again, that other people were telling you?
I tend to be a more thematic writer than some people. Partly of that writing journal that I keep, I'll go over pages and I'll tell myself, this theme is emerging, and then that tells me to go back and highlight those things sometimes. So definitely, you know, and Pat Bender, his entire chapter to me is the artist's sort of inability to proceed without being a self-promoter now. You know, it used to be, as Pat says, that as soon as a band started self-promoting and doing that stuff, that you hated them. They lost their cool. And now there is no promotion but self-promotion. So every band, every writer, I worry now that writers will need a platform. They'll need a Facebook page and a Twitter feed. And, you know, and you wonder about a writer like Cormac McCarthy or Don DeLillo. You know, how would these guys be discovered if they just want to write, or Edward P. Jones, you know, and have their writing speak for them, not have to have some other public persona that they manage and brand and carry around and that drives the sales of their fiction. You know, it's that distresses me in some way.
Well, I noticed, for instance, your own website. It's there. It's got everything, but it doesn't have everything.
Right.
It's kind of just at a certain point to go, okay, I've got to have one. This is what I'm going to have.
I honestly think the best way to discover my work is by reading my work. Anything else that I could say, you know, and it can be the difficulty of finishing a book. You work on something for years, and it's 110,000 words, and it really is everything you had to say. And then to try to define it in some other way can be difficult.
Jess Walter, you also work on a lot of short fiction. Is that also a palate cleanser?
It is, and you know, I feel like stories bubble up in me all the time, and I don't know what form they'll take. Sometimes I think this would make a great film. Other times I think this would make a great short story. After sending out those Manila boomerangs for years, to be in a place now where my fiction is more widely published, my short fiction is great. I love the form, and I think, like most writers, I come at this as a reader. You know, I want to create in other readers the effects that writers created in me, and sometimes a short story writer like Tobias Wolff, I can't imagine a better sentence, a better form, a better completion of its own fictional work. And so I'm driven to try to emulate that, usually in a much paler and less successful way.
You did say again in that 2010 interview that you see plot as this beautiful, elegant shape, whereas a lot of people just focus on beautiful writing. And someone like Laurie Moore is perfect for a short story, but when you get to the novel phase, suddenly all you've got is the beautiful writing.
Yeah, and I've taught in a few MFA programs, and if I could make a criticism of MFA programs, it's that they, one writer called it the cult of the sentence, that there is such a focus on a kind of poetic lyricism, which is wonderful. I love it in fiction. But I do think that these larger forms and shapes, that a story itself can be as artful as any great sentence or paragraph. David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, to me, that Russian nesting doll of a structure, one story inside another, is as elegant and lovely as any sentence I've ever seen.
Jess Walter, you said that you work on multiple books. How many books are going on right now?
Well, I have two novels that I've been toying with. One is a quiet, kind of desperate urban stretch. You know, I see it as this character pushed, trying to react, and I think it'll be a short novel, tense and probably full of action. And then another one is a more comic novel about a suburban cattle ranch, which is comes sort of loosely from my own past. And so both of those books have been kicking around. I have a book of short stories coming out next March, which is the thing I'm doing now, which almost all of them have been published. I think all of them have now. And so I'm just trying to find the right order, you know, and make sure that they fit together some way. And then I'm always writing new stories, new short stories.
Are we ever going to see any outtakes from Beautiful Ruins?
Outtakes, yeah. That would be sort of funny. The blooper reel, yeah. With me pitching, no, I think the book is as it was meant to be at some level, and whatever else, you know, was discarded over those 15 years was probably discarded for a very good reason.
You've been listening to an interview with Jess Walter, whose latest novel is Beautiful Ruins. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.